From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a debate in Michigan's Senate race is in the planning stages.
Voters clearly want debates.
Plus, new stadium deals. Do reporters do enough digging into the promises team owners make?
I think it's important for reporters to cite such numbers with a grain of salt. The media narrative takes shape on day one stories in a lot of cases.
What's behind a growing grassroots movement to get the Pope to visit Detroit in 2015?
They're excited about what's happening in Detroit. They want sort of the Pope's blessing.
And we meet the captain of the number one ranked team at the University of Michigan, women's cross country.
Everyone really, really wants to get to that top spot, and the drive that this team has is tenfold what I think it was a few years ago.
This summer's announcement of a huge new downtown arena for the Detroit Red Wings triggered a flood of news stories. But were the right questions being asked right from the get-go? I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, why media across the country struggle when covering new stadium construction. Then to the best sports team on Michigan's campus that you've never heard about. But first, news today in the race to become the next U.S. Senator from Michigan. Republican Terry Lindland has taken the first step towards holding a debate with Democratic rival Gary Peters. With 48 days to go until the November election, there are a lot of folks wondering if Michigan voters would ever get a chance to hear a debate between the candidates for U.S. Senate and, by the way, for governor. Here now is Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics team, Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. Hey, you two.
Hey, Cindy.
Hello.
Rick, what has Terry Lindland done that indicates that at least the door is opened and she's at least thinking of debating Gary Peters?
Not just thinking, that they are debating the terms, that she has named a prominent Lansing attorney, Richard McClellan, who has a lot of experience in these sorts of things, as her debate negotiator with former Lieutenant Governor John Cherry, who's doing that duty for the Gary Peters campaign. They would like to do it in the studios of Channel 7 in Detroit with longtime Spotlight on the News moderator Chuck Stokes and a still unnamed news anchor from somewhere over in West Michigan. So both sides of the state would be represented.
Things are beginning to move toward that. And I know, Zoe, we've talked about this a lot. The debate, are we going to see debates?
The debate over debates.
Yeah. Are voters actually looking for a debate, or is this something that charges up political reporters like you and Rick?
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, look, we all want, as political reporters, as political watchers, we want the debates. And it's not just for the fun action of it, right? That it's a time where we can actually dig a little deeper into specific questions, one would hope. Mm-hmm. I have to say that at least Michigan radio listeners, the comments and folks that I've spoken to really do want debates. And so one thing I think that the campaigns who are maybe shying away from them or have been are going, no, we'll talk to the voters directly. We just don't think debates are needed. And so it's a little bit of a nuanced argument. It's a fine line.
I think there are two elements to that equation. One of them is voters clearly want debates. They at least expect that candidates will stand up and debate each other.
Right.
That does not necessarily mean, though, that they will tune in for those debates. And we know, actually, that most people are informed about what happens at a debate, not by viewing or listening to a debate, but by the coverage that follows
or
it.
Or in these days, the tweets issue that are going along with it, the Facebook posts, what their friends are saying.
And then the other element is that whether or not voters actually expect and want debates, does that mean that failing to participate in one would actually, change, how they would vote. And I think we're seeing some things that would suggest that both Terry Lindland and Governor Snyder would like to step away from the, as you said, Zoe, the debate on debates to try and retire that and not make it look like they're somehow avoiding voters' questions.
That they're ducking.
Well, because that's what the headlines have become about at this point, is exactly this sort of, are you too chicken to debate, ducking the debates? We had Gary Peters, in fact, debate an empty chair last week, a chair that was meant for Terry Lindland. So we're even getting into the gimmicks now.
Because Peters has said yes to any debate request.
He hasn't
that
just
came
said yes. Yeah. I mean, he's like begging for them. He's like going to people, hey, you want to have a debate? You want to have a debate?
Rick, kind of compare and contrast the media styles of these candidates. Let's drill in right now with Terry Lindland and Gary Peters.
Gary Peters is someone who enjoys those sorts of interactions. He likes breaking apart policies and explaining things. Terry Land is more comfortable in a much more controlled environment. And I expect that, you know, we'll see some of those things play out as the debate format for the one that we think is going to happen as those are negotiated. And they'll be talking about everything from how the stage is going to be lit. Will they be standing? Will they be sitting? Where will they be vis-a-vis each other? How will you handle the spin room after? I mean, all that stuff gets put on the table. And from the campaign perspective, very much focuses on the candidates' comfort levels.
It goes down to, you know, how high the podiums are. Are there going to be podiums? But I think, Cindy, what your question really is about is this idea of Terry Lynn Land shying away from the media, or at least that's the narrative that folks have wanted to push. And her thing is like, no, I'm meeting with voters. I'm talking to people. Why does it need to go through the media, you know, in that way? And so, we've seen even national headlines going, you know, the hidden Senate candidate, you know, yes. Senate candidate in hiding. And I think that's partly why we're seeing this movement today.
And that's the narrative that her campaign needs to arrest, that this is playing out, that she's a candidate in hiding. And so, you know, we're going to see her, you know, come out and debate at least once. We should point out that she, like Gary Peters has already, will also be taking questions for an hour on public radio stations here in Michigan as well.
Which is what I was going to say, that you, Rick, will be hosting that. You'll be moderating.
And you, Zoe, will be producing it.
I will be. but I mean, what that shows is, look, she is going to be answering questions on October 3rd. They have confirmed an hour long, you know, voters can call in, they can tweet in, they can Facebook page, more details to come, like that little
preview. But get your questions out there.
Well, yeah. Right. So what she's saying, or the campaign is saying, hey, you know, we want this direct contact with the voters. We don't want to have to put it through you kind of maybe mean media, or however you want to, you know, talk about
that. Because we've noticed, this campaign has gone on, is reading stories when they are about Terry Lynn Land. They don't feature quotes from Terry Lynn Land. They feature statements from the campaign. And don't voters have a right to expect to hear directly from the candidate?
Right. Well, I think
and Republicans are seeing that just too much bandwidth is being taken up by this discussion about debates, confrontations, meeting with voters, which is also why we've seen, you know, Governor Snyder announce today that he's going to do, Zoe, I think it's 20 town halls.
Oh, you wish. 10 town hall events across 20. We would love. Let's just do one a day until election day.
Now you got a chance
two
to
a day.
Have 48.
Let's just do that all day, every day.
Nobody wants.
No, Rick, but 10 town halls across the state. He's going to kick off the Road to Recovery Tour. Doesn't that sound like some, like, band? The Road to Recovery Tour will begin in late September.
But still no confirmed public debates between Governor Snyder and his Democratic challenger, Mark Schauer. So how surprising is that?
And Mark Schauer, you know, put out a statement saying that this is a poor substitute for debates. And the Snyder line is just that I'm happy to take questions from voters, but he doesn't want to engage in the political process. That, you know, sort of his brand is that he's supposed to be outside that. But of course, he is a politician and he's not.
Right. I mean, as you mentioned, Schauer's campaign said, quote, "Let's be clear, what the governor proposed today is a political stunt."
Rick, you have covered Lansing for more than 25 years. In the end, do debates really, really matter, or is it more theater?
Yes, they do. And the theater matters as well. And I mean, we've seen time and time again, I mean, the biggest danger, especially for front runners in a debate, is they will gaffe.
The gaffe, the oops moment. And Rick and I have talked about this, that you don't get a lot from a good debate performance, but you can lose
you
a lot
a
from a bad debate
Ask
performance.
Ask Rick Perry at Oakland University when he couldn't remember all the departments he was going to get
right,
rid of.
Right, exactly. And he had that oops moment, and now he's followed around with that sort of jokingly oops. And Rick and I have talked about this. We have an instance in
Michigan history where it was a Secretary of State campaign between Candace Miller and Richard Austin, who, you know, been the longtime Secretary of State. He seemed to forget things, primarily what it meant to be on the abortion question, pro-life versus pro-choice. And after that performance, the Miller campaign literally made copies of the TV show and widely circulated it so that people could see a Secretary of State who seemed to be out of touch. You know, really, there is more to lose than to gain. But because, call it theater, call it what you will, it is still an expected part of the political process. You ignore it altogether at your peril.
And Cindy, what we know is debates are sort of part of an American institution. I mean, we can all remember 1960, JFK, mm-hmm. Nixon, you know, folks who watched it on TV thought that JFK won, folks that listened to it on the radio that Nixon had. So we know mm-hmm. debates have a long history and it
Lincoln
works.
Douglas.
Lincoln Douglas. So, right. You know, they're emotional and they bring up issues of voters feeling connected. And so there is sort of a deeper thing going on here. I mean, we're sort of having fun talking about the debate over debates, but I think it is fair to say that issues, talking about issues are important. And I'm going to steal this line from Nolan Finley at the Detroit News, who said, you know, it's interesting to note that the Senate is the U.S. body of debate. That was what our founding fathers constitutionally wanted, that the Senate would be where big issues of the day were gone to debate.
And home of the filibuster.
Right. Stand up, keep talking, passionate. And what we want from our leaders, or at least I think most people do, is a feeling that they're willing to stand up and debate their issues. You may not agree with what they're saying, but you at least want to hear where they stand and hear some passion and verve about what they believe in. And so that's been interesting to watch, too.
The debate over the debates with our It's Just Politics team. Zoe Clark, Rick Pluta, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks, Cindy.
Oh, you bet.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The last time a pope visited Michigan was 27 years ago this very week. St. John Paul II spoke to crowds at Hart Plaza and Blessed Sacrament Cathedral in Detroit. He visited Hamtramck and then celebrated Mass for 90,000 people at the Pontiac Silver Dome. Word that Pope Francis is planning a visit to the United States next year has ignited a letter-writing and social media campaign called Let's Bring Pope Francis to Detroit in 2015. The spark of the campaign began at Detroit Cristo Rey High School. It's in southwest Detroit. Principal Sue Rowe is here with us, and this movement's drawing support from big names, including Detroit's mayor and deputy mayor. We have Detroit Deputy Mayor Ike McKinnon with us as well. All right, I'm going to ask you both the question that's probably top of mind for many who hear about this story. Why Detroit? I mean, out of all the cities in the United States, Detroit? Sue, you take it first.
Well, the students felt that the city of Detroit could use the holiness that the Pope could bring and that the Pope could lead us in a way to move forward with Detroit. They're excited about what's happening in Detroit. They want sort of the Pope's blessing, and they know that the Pope really is very pastoral toward people that are somewhat disenfranchised or sometimes looked down upon. And they felt that the city of Detroit has taken enough knocks, and they would hope that the Pope would come here and pray with us and help us to continue our revitalization.
And to add to that, I mean, with all the good things that are happening right now, think about where we've gone or where we've been, and as we come back to the great things that are happening in the last 8 months or so, and to say, boy, this is one of those great positive things that could happen or will happen to our city, and the light that will shine on the city from the world.
So your students have been busy. They've launched not just the letter-writing campaign, but there's a Facebook campaign going, Let's Bring Pope Francis to Detroit in 2015. What's been the message? Who are they talking to?
They're talking to anyone who will listen to them. They're big movement at this point is let's get as much support as we can from Catholics, non-Catholics, people that like the Pope. One of our Muslim students is on this committee, and he said, you know, Muslim people like the Pope too. I want to be involved with this. And we're starting, since the Free Press and USA Today picked up the Free Press article, we're getting calls from Catholic institutions, you know, across the Midwest here, Ohio and Illinois, and saying, this is a great thing you're doing, and, you know, let us know if we can help you. So it's been wonderful.
And we've seen in recent years, Ike McKinnon, how, for example, you get a groundswell of support. The Detroit hosted the Super Bowl, and you had a Roger Penske who was pivotal in pulling that effort together and getting the Grand Prix going and up and running on Belle Isle. What, from where you're sitting now as deputy mayor and working with Mayor Duggan, who else is coming on board, or do you want to get on board this effort?
Well, let's put it this way. We know that there will be loads of people who would want to get involved with this because it impacts everyone. And think about this. The Pope comes to town, or his, the impact of just his presence touches so many people. And that being the case, whether it's the Super Bowl or the Grand Prix, that impacts so many people also. But having him here would touch the lives of so many people just visiting our city and then seeing our city, the turnaround that's going on. And so I think we would see a tremendous outpouring of support for him and for our city.
And what does the Archdiocese of Detroit say? Archbishop Alan Vigneron, I'm sure you need his support to move this ahead.
Well, the mayor and I met with the Archbishop a couple of weeks ago, and he's supportive of the idea, and his ideas, I think his words were that he's going to share the letters with Rome.
Well,
with the Vatican, I should say.
Well, that certainly, he would be the conduit for doing that. But and then are you, if this is mushrooming, are you, do you have ideas of other important people in Michigan that you want to recruit to the cause, if I could put it that way?
Well, I think that by getting this message out, number one, the article in the Free Press, was the start. Others would know that if the Pope comes to Detroit, that's impacting Chicago, it's impacting Cleveland, it's impacting other cities where people would come from throughout the country to Detroit. And so those people would want to get involved also. And throughout the state of Michigan and Canada, people would want to come from throughout to be here to see the Pope. The last time he was here, I recall, the number of people who came to this area to see the Pope, to hear his message. The Silver Dome was packed at that point. I'm envisioning that Ford Field would be the place this time, but just the people from throughout the, not just the metropolitan area, but probably from South America and on, to see and hear him here.
Ike, I have to put this out here and ask, can the city afford whatever it would cost to host a papal visit? Because I'm sure you're considering the optics of spending money on a papal visit in a bankrupt city that is just trying now to get up off the floor and get up onto its knees and stand up.
I think that would be the least of the concerns because, as you said, those people who would want to have him come here would come out and support the mayor and Sue and others in this effort to have him here. The residual effects are so much greater than probably spending, let's say, money for police protection and on and on. I think those people who would come out and support that, it would be just tremendous.
Sue, what do you think it will take to get Pope Francis to include Detroit on his U.S. visit in 2015?
I think it'll take a lot of prayer and enthusiasm. You know, Pope Francis is a worldwide figure, but we know that he's a compassionate person and, you know, reaches out to a lot of different types of people. He doesn't always follow the status quo. So my hope is, you know, it started as kind of a civics lesson in leadership and perseverance and, you know, how to get kids involved in leadership, not only in the school, but maybe making a difference in our community. And already that part is happening, and that's a wonderful, wonderful message for our students to see. If the Pope actually comes to Detroit, there's going to be no stopping those kids. They are going to definitely step up and take leadership roles here in the city. They're all Detroit kids. They love the city. They want the city to shine, and they definitely would embrace Pope Francis. It would change their lives, I think, in a lot of ways, if he were to come to Detroit.
And to you, Ike McKinnon, what do you think it will take to seal this deal and get the Pope to put Detroit on his agenda?
I think, in all sincerity, a lot of us praying, a lot of us hoping, and those letters having the impact that we want to on him. And, of course, the realization that our city needs his visit.
Yep.
We need his visit.
Detroit Deputy Mayor Ike McKinnon and Detroit Crystal Ray's Principal Sue Rowe behind this campaign, Let's Bring Pope Francis to Detroit in 2015. Thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside today.
Thank you.
Can a brightly painted and decorated bench make a downtown area more attractive, actually bring more people downtown? My next guest says Absolutely. Artist Jim Ault of Lapeer has launched something he calls the Bench Warming Project. Jim, you're looking at a humble street bench and you see big possibilities?
It's a blank canvas. You know, it's kind of limited to the artist's imagination. They can take it anywhere from an optical illusion to a landscape to just a bright, colorful piece of artwork and brighten up a community. You know, kind of refocuses the downtown.
What is your goal with the Bench Warming Project?
The long-term goal and the ultimate goal is to give downtown Lapeer just kind of a positive collection of public artwork that will help bring people back to our downtown community. That's our long-term goal.
Now, you set a fundraising goal of $1,000 on GoFundMe.com, and you have more than doubled that. Why do you think this benchwarming project is resonating with people who are donating?
I think part of it is it's something unique. We haven't seen this done anywhere in Michigan, so it's something that the community can kind of be proud of and showcase our downtown. And I think it's also resonating because this is an opportunity for people in the community and groups of artists to give back to the town. This is done completely with volunteers, artists, and just community members. You know, there's no organization or anything like that attached to it. So it kind of, like I said, gives them that ownership into the project.
How far along are you?
We have about 4 benches that are finished. There are 21 benches in all, and we are hoping to be done with all of them in about the next week or so.
Jim, is there a bigger message here, do you think, than just decorating benches? Is this, do you think, some kind of affirmation of that the arts do indeed matter to people?
They do. You know, if you look all over the country, especially in small towns or towns and communities that are struggling, you know, a lot of those communities are depending on the arts to rejuvenate a downtown. You know, a big part of what can impact a city and a town is people want to have that connection to it. They want to be able to say, you know, we love this about our community. And the arts are something that people can grab onto and give them that focal point. And it's kind of like a rebirth, you know, type situation where they can take this and spur a movement and start growing their towns again. So it's just a really positive thing they can grab onto and go with.
Artist Jim Ault of Lapeer has launched the Bench Warming Project to get the benches in downtown Lapeer brightly painted by local artists. Jim Ault, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, it's pretty much an understatement to say that football and basketball at the University of Michigan get the lion's share of athletic attention. But the best team on campus, the one ranked number one in the nation, is the Michigan women's cross-country team. Senior Captain Brooke Handler of Rochester Hills is with us now. And Brooke, congratulations on being picked as number one in the Division I preseason coaches poll. This is a first for Michigan women's cross-country, isn't it?
Yeah, we were definitely really excited to see it. We kind of know how the rankings work, so we knew we were returning a full team, and we got fourth last year and improved a lot in track, so we were kind of expecting to be up there, but I don't know, you never want to put any, I don't know, kind of outside pressure on yourself, so
you just
we were
focused.
Excited.
Yeah. Yeah, when you got the word, was there a sense of us, or you were feeling, how did you feel?
I mean, we know how the rankings work. They base it off of what you did last year and who you returned. So we knew we'd be up there. But also the rankings can miss people who improve a lot over the last year or just had a bad meet last year. So we try to not put too much emphasis on it, but we were excited.
And does it make you grind your teeth a little bit, honestly, in frustration when all you hear about on campus is football, 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 and here you guys are ranked the top team in the country? I mean, you women are kicking some serious butt in cross country, but kind of all you hear is football now, and then comes the hoops. Is there a part of you that wants to go, hi, we're here?
We tend to not compare ourselves to the other sport teams. I think that if us being ranked number one makes a few more people excited about the women's cross country team, that would be, I don't know, all we would hope for.
Well, I wondered, is this kind of the way it is in cross country? And I'll ask that because when my daughter ran cross country in high school, I think the team kind of always felt they were kind of overshadowed by some of the other sports, especially at her school, soccer and volleyball. It was all about that. And so it was basically your parents coming to the meet and running around the course to cheer you guys on. Is cross country a little too easily overlooked, do you think?
Sometimes. There are definitely like a lot of excitement and hype around some of the other sports. But the thing about running is it's such a community, and the running community in Michigan has always supported University of Michigan cross country. So we felt the support for a long time. But it is cool to be recognized by more than just the running community, like we're being recognized this year.
Now, what do you think makes your team so good and so successful?
I think the special thing about the team this year is just how much everyone wants to be good. Everyone really, really wants to get to that top spot. And the drive that this team has is tenfold what I think it was a few years ago. And I think that's just because we are just together and training together hard every day.
What do you want to say about your coach, about your head coach, Mike McGuire? 23 years now as cross-country coach at Michigan? That's pretty incredible.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We all completely trust Mike. He's one of the most respected coaches in the business. He's had countless Olympians. We all know that he's going to train us so that we're ready to race on race day.
What does it feel like when you're racing? Like, where do you go in your head as you're doing that? Because it's grueling. You're going up hills and you're going into forests. And,
yeah.
You know, what's going on?
That's something that's different about cross country from other sports is you have to put yourself in as much pain as you possibly can. Whereas when I run the mile and track, I'm not in the most pain that I can possibly be in. But during cross, you have to dig deep and reach that mental state where you can push yourself as hard as you possibly can. And the easiest way to do that is just relying on your teammates. When I have races that I do the entire race with someone like Shannon or Taylor, I can just reach down and push myself so much harder than I ever could do alone. So that's kind of what we do as a team, is push each other and lean on each other during races.
And I liked what you said about the running community. And by that, I mean, I remember going to the high school cross country meets and being so blown away when there would be parents from all the different schools roaring and cheering for the kids who were, you know, not great runners, but they were in there plugging away and cheering them across to help them finish. Didn't matter what school they were from, but it was just a matter of recognizing what it took to make this happen. And I see what you mean by that running community. It's kind of a special family, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I think there was a ad slogan for Adidas from like a few years ago that was like, runners, yeah, we're different. And like a bunch of different like shots of runners doing things that only runners do. And you know it if you know it.
How do you like your chances of winning your first national championship in program history? Is that on your mind as you're out there running?
No, it's not on our mind every day. It's kind of an unspoken thing. We know that if we stay healthy and follow the process and follow what Mike is telling us to do, that it's a possibility. But I think if you go out and say, we're going to win the championship this year, you can sometimes put too much pressure on yourself. And that pressure can be debilitating sometimes, especially in such a mental sport.
Brooke Handler, the senior captain of the University of Michigan women's cross-country team, the only Wolverine team that's ranked number one in the nation. Good luck with the season and good luck as you chase that first national championship, Brooke.
Thank you so much.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 2 months ago, plans were unveiled for a new sports and entertainment district to be built on largely vacant land between downtown and midtown Detroit. The centerpiece of the development would be a brand new home for the Detroit Red Wings. The developers would be Olympia Development of Michigan, owned by the Illich family, the same family that owns the Red Wings. Tomorrow night, the public gets its first close look at the details of the new $450 million arena at a meeting of the Detroit City Planning Commission. David Uberti recently wrote a piece for the Columbia Journalism Review. He looked at the way reporters cover new stadium construction stories, not just in Detroit, but across the country. And he notes a distinct cheerlead first, ask questions later approach. Good to have you with us, David.
Thanks for having me.
You looked at news coverage in cities all across the country, not just Detroit. And it seems you did not have to look too hard to find coverage that seems to be a lot more rah-rah and a lot less probing.
Sure. Now, of course, this is an issue in almost every major American city. And the difficulty of covering this from a reporter's perspective stems in large part from the fact that it takes place at the intersection of three very different subjects, those being sports, business, and politics. So in a lot of cases, you might have sports reporters who could be overwhelmed by the economic aspects of these projects, where in other cases, you might have economics reporters who might not truly understand the sports aspects of this. So it's very easy to cover in a very servicey way. And what's more, a lot of these sports organizations have proven very adept at managing the media message. They have a lot of resources, and obviously, given the fact that they are in the entertainment business, They are very proactive and very effective at marketing their wares to the general public.
Well, July 20th is when the Illich organization announced plans for a new Red Wing Stadium. And you included a clip from a report done on WXYZ-TV, the ABC affiliate in Detroit. Let's take a listen to excerpts from that.
On his 85th birthday, Red Wings owner Mike Illich and his organization released the tales of a new sports and entertainment district. The Illich organization says the project will generate nearly $2 billion in total economic impact, as well as thousands of new jobs.
It's a plan that promises to make downtown Detroit the shopping, dining, and entertainment mecca of tomorrow. These are the first public renderings of Red Wings owner Mike Illich's vision for the $650 million sports and entertainment district. The blueprint takes dozens of blighted blocks along and near Woodward Avenue and transforms them into neighborhoods anchored by Comerica Park, Ford Field, the Fox Theater, and other landmarks.
I think it's going to be great.
Why did you choose that report, David?
Well, I mean, you see in this report one of the hallmarks of poor coverage when you're talking about stadium construction here, namely the fact that the anchor and they cited the projections of $2 billion in economic spinoffs along with thousands of jobs. I will say that there are a number of reasons why the arena district looks promising for Detroit, but at the same time, academic literature and economic analysis of these plans is almost universally in agreement that such projections are way off the mark. While it is important to cite these projections because in a lot of cases, as with Detroit, they do have well-known economists carrying them out, it's also healthy to have a big dose of skepticism when relaying that information.
There is kind of an energy, if you will, that almost sounds like it could be something that the sports team itself put out about this story. And I'm wondering, is that because trying to take a deep dive into the complexities of a stadium financing deal, it's just impossible in a minute 15 package for that 5 p.m. news? Those reporters don't even get 90 seconds usually to tell their stories.
Sure. No, that's definitely part of the problem. I spoke with a number of people in the Detroit area who covered this, and they said that the Illich family had given them basically 24 hours before they had to publish this. So that's really not enough time to do any sort of deep analysis on the economic spinoffs or perhaps even the development spinoffs that could be possible with such a project. And with the case of a news reporter, for example, as you mentioned, a 90-second package is not nearly enough time to really delve deep into some of the corresponding economic questions here.
And in fact, I know you spoke with an editor from Crain's Detroit Business who pointed out, really, it's separate stories. It's the here's what the Illiches are saying they want to do, and then a subsequent story could be that deeper dive that asks tougher questions.
And Detroit is lucky to have a guy like Bill Shea, who's actually very adept at covering the sports business world. And obviously, it does take a very long time to really present a nuanced analysis of such plans. Having said that, I think it's important for reporters in Detroit or elsewhere to cite such numbers with a grain of salt. Obviously, the media narrative takes shape on day one stories in a lot of cases. So by not expressing some sort of skepticism at such projections, they could be leading their readers on to expect something that's not likely to happen.
I'm talking with David Uberti, who's with the Columbia Journalism Review. He wrote a piece for CJR looking at why it is local media struggle covering sports stadium construction. And I have to wonder, as you analyze these stories from across the country, do you find that it's easy for reporters to get overly caught up in the buzz of a big sports story? And by that, I'll cite something from some years ago when I was a reporter for a TV station in Detroit, and the Pistons won the playoff. And whoever did the live shot that night was kind of scolded the next day because it was all about we this and we did that and we won. And she was waving the big foam rubber number one finger, we. And it was pointed out the next day, hey, folks, we're supposed to be objective reporters. Do they drink the Kool-Aid?
In some cases, they have drank the Kool-Aid. Obviously, everyone wants to be behind a winner. And obviously, sports teams help form an integral part of local identities in Detroit or Buffalo or elsewhere across the country. But the challenge for reporters, as I say in my piece, is they have to evaluate both the tangible, those being the economic spinoffs and development spinoffs and whatnot, and the intangible benefits of having a franchise in town. The challenge for them is to ensure that the reporting on one doesn't affect the reporting on the other.
Yeah, and as you know, America likes a winner, and so do its readers, viewers, and listeners. And, you know, the difference between being a major league town and a minor league town and people's minds is big. So there is a lot of reason to kind of generate extra buzz.
Oh, there sure is. And it also is worth mentioning that media are stakeholders in this. Sports represent a huge part of local newscasts or local newspapers. Sports sections are often the largest sections in local newspapers and whatnot. And if, say, the Red Wings were to skip town and go to a different locale, the first person who might lose their job is the Detroit Red Wings reporter. So obviously there is an interest in keeping teams in town, but that shouldn't be an excuse to allow some of this hometown rah-rah coverage to cloud media skepticism.
And we should note that there were people that did do that deeper dive as the story progressed, but as you say, day one coverage kind of drives it. So what are you saying, David Uberti, in your Columbia Journalism Review piece, to the public who reads, watches, and listens to these stories?
I'd say just remain skeptical. Obviously, academic literature is becoming more widespread in this topic. Economists are almost in full agreement that stadiums don't usually produce the promises that have initially been laid out. But as far as what citizens should think about is that this is, in a lot of cases, a political question. Should local governments, be they city government or state government, subsidize a local business? They have to evaluate by themselves whether that's worth it. But I will say that media coverage across the country is getting better in this respect because, in a lot of cases, different cities have gotten burned by stadiums that did not pan out.
David Uberti is a Delacorte Fellow with the Columbia Journalism Review. You can find his piece, Why Local Media Struggle Covering Sports Stadium Construction, at cjr.org. Good to talk with you, David. Thank you.
Thanks.
One of the gifted architects who helped Detroit earn a 19th century reputation as the Paris of the West was Louis Camper. Historian Bill Loomis recently wrote about Camper. Bill, why is Louis Camper called the grand old man of Detroit architecture?
Well, he gave Detroit its look, really. All those buildings that he did, really, when people think of Detroit buildings, even though he didn't do the Fisher Building or the Penobscot Building, that Detroit Art Deco and that look is very much Louis Camper. And he also did such a huge variety of things, not just skyscrapers. He did homes, he did bridges, he did...
Did a police station?
A police station, right. He did it all.
Now, he was only 26 when he came to Detroit, but he's originally from Bavaria, right?
That's right. He was born in 1861 in Bavaria, and he trained in Germany. And then he came to the States in the early 80s, like 82, and worked for...
And, of course, we're saying 1882.
Yeah, oh, sorry. Right. Got to make sure that's right. Yeah. 1882, and he worked for the venerable McKim, Mead, and White firm in New York. They were world famous. And then he came. He heard that a lot was going on in Detroit. Plus, there were a lot of Germans in Detroit.
And when he comes at age 26, which is just amazing. So he begins to transform Detroit. Let's go down some of his biggest contributions. And as I read your piece, I'm so excited, as you wrote about the Hecker House, because that is where I had my grade school piano recitals when it was the Smiley Brothers Piano Company right there on Woodward.
Amazing.
The little gatehouse or the little carriage house in the back.
Right.
There was a piano there, and schools could rent that space for their recitals. So as I drove down Woodward from Ferndale praying that God would strike me dead before I had to get up there and play Surf Riders in front of everybody. I'm talking fourth grade here.
Those thoughts never leave us, do they?
No, they don't. I remember if the John Ivory sign was, if we hit that, I'm going down Woodward on the building. I was going to have, fate was, did not go my way. I was still alive and I'd have to play in the recital.
Too funny.
But I remember that beautiful building and it was a thrill to go there. The Hecker House has been a law firm for a while and now it's for sale. But tell us about this incredible, beautiful building.
Well, that was his first commission was to design this house. It's 21,000 square feet. Frank Hecker owned the Peninsula Car Company, a railroad car. So he was part of that 19th century wealth. And they wanted houses to reflect that. And Upper Woodward, North Woodward there, had become the hot spot for wealthy, big, huge homes. So he didn't like the rusticated stone of Lake Superior, that kind of castly look that a lot of buildings in Detroit had. And Camper said, well, Detroit's a French town. Let's make a French chateau. So that's what he did. And it's modeled off of a French chateau style, chateau-esque it's called. It's got turrets and towers and seashells and everything. It was, when it originally was built, it was white, and people thought of it as the White Palace. That's what they called it. It predated other houses on Woodward Avenue.
Like the David Whitney home?
The David Whitney home,
where the Whitney restaurant is right now.
Exactly, the mansion there. But it's really an outstanding, beautiful piece. That's the beauty of Camper, is he can do a fantasy piece almost like that, but still make it dignified. It's not like you're at Disney World or something like that. These are beautiful homes.
Very true. And I had to laugh when I was reading your piece that the price tag was $52,000 for 21,000 square feet.
I know.
Talk about the 8th Precinct Police Station.
Yeah, that was done a few years later, 1901. That was done in the same style. And if you see it or see pictures of it, it's still standing. In fact, it's been turned into condominiums. It's a National Historic Site. It is just beautiful. You know, it's hard to imagine a police station challenging Camper to come up with something. But he, again, did with that French style. So it has turrets and it has all kinds of beautiful decorations. But that was a new area, Woodbridge, and they wanted a police station that reflected their upper middle class status, you know. That was where Ty Cobb lived and a few others. So,
all right.
It had to look good.
Now, his association with the Book family led to some very transformative buildings.
Yes. He started out building a home for James Book, J.B. It's on Jefferson. It's being rehabbed right now.
It's on
East Jefferson, right really near Sequoia, near the...
near Indian Village.
Indian Village, yeah. Seminole. And it's a beautiful Italianate style house, much like you'd see in Rhode Island and Newport and things like that, big square blocky house with, and his own house is the same way. In Indian Village, you can see Camper's own house, the same kind of style. And he and James got along so well, they became friends and went to Europe together and were inspired from what they saw from these different palaces and palazzos and stuff like that.
And so the Book Cadillac Hotel was a result of that. So it wasn't all just homes.
Yeah, well, the Books inherited money from their grandfather, Francis Palm, who was, there's the Palm Apartments. He was a big man in Detroit for many, many years, a couple generations before.
Okay.
So they inherited about $300 million, maybe not quite that much. And they had decided that Washington Boulevard, which was kind of a forgotten corridor of downtown, would be a great place to rejuvenate the area and turn it into the Fifth Avenue of Detroit. So they widened the boulevard, started planning buildings for downtown. They wanted elegant shops and a real grand style. So the first building they came up with was called the Book Building. And it's, again, in that Italianate sort of style. It's a blocky limestone building, an office building. It was really Camper's first major office building. And that was followed by the Book Tower, which was designed in 1916. Everybody knows the Book Tower. It's 38 stories. It looks a little odd. It was at the time a very elegant and prestigious place to have your office. But it is interesting. It's highly ornamented, yet it's a skyscraper. So Camper seemed to be trying to work out some things there.
And then as he got to the hotel, which happily has been restored to its former glory and is worth going to see.
Definitely.
After decades of seeing it decaying in the corner.
There.
Boy.
You know, it sort of was spared just because Detroit didn't have the money to tear it down, thank goodness. So it was restored in 2006. At the time it was built, it was the biggest hotel in the world. It's 1,300 rooms, 31 floors. It's just enormous. It has, you know, Roast, the famous restaurant in Detroit
Michael
now.
Simon.
Roast is it right there. And if you go up to into the main floor, you'll see some of the embellishments and some of the details that Camper did for the hotel.
So as you walk, because you do, you take the elevator up, and then there are ballrooms in that. Have they been all fairly authentically restored?
Yes, right. Now, the main floor has been changed completely and modernized. But if you go up to those upper floors, you can see what Camper had in mind.
And I wonder what they would think of Washington Boulevard with some of the modernized lights and things that you're pulling a little face as well. I see
I
you wince.
Well, they keep trying to do what they can. And there's always talk about restoring the Book Tower and Book Building are both empty. And they've been so since like 2008 or more. And there's hope of bringing them back. The company that owns them now out of Vancouver, British Columbia, has said they're bringing them back, but there's been no specific date.
And this gentleman, Lewis Camper, boy, he lived to a ripe old age of 92. He didn't die till 1953.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, he's been sort of a difficult character to research. He was really a German. He did a lot of buildings for the German community in Detroit. He had a very thick German accent. So anytime he's quoted in the paper, it's always with that fakey German lingo. So he didn't make a lot of appearances, public appearances. And basically, he stopped building buildings in 1930 with the Depression. He had planned, you know, the big mega book tower that was 81 stories.
The greatest camper structure never built?
Yeah, exactly. The greatest camper structure never built that was going to abut the book building. So it was going to be the book tower, the book building, and then this 81-story superstructure. And there are pictures of it, but it was never built because of the Depression. And it really ended Camper's career. Architecture is so linked to the economy that once things start to tank, all those plans go away.
So for those last 20 years...
I've talked to several people about it, and he really went into kind of disappeared. But he was in his 60s, so he probably felt he could retire.
Fascinating story about architect Lewis Camper, who really has left many, many memorable marks on the city of Detroit. And happy to hear that so many of them have been restored or are in good shape or could be in line to be restored.
Right, exactly.
Thank you so much, Bill Loom. It's always fun exploring Detroit's history with you.
You bet, Cindy.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our director today was Allie Billings, and our engineer was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mike Blank, Michelle Hahn, Haley Hirschman, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty, and thank you so much for listening.